Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. In this episode, I'm joined by Emmy Award-winning writer David Quantick. Hello.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be back on your new podcast for the first time.
Last time I saw you was your book launch.
Golden Days. Golden Days, yes. That's And Other Stories, published by Into Books,
yes.
By the way. That's the book you're talking about.
Very good book it is. And you've got a couple of other books.
That's right. I've got an all-ages novella called Imagine a Friend coming out, which I really, really love. It's sort of about being a teenager and growing up and all kinds of spooky stuff. And I've got a proper novel coming out in November called The Hyena, which is about a 1930s female painter who didn't actually exist. But it's one of those novels where someone's at the fringes of everything. And I really like that one. And there's more after that, as we may well touch on, who knows.
One in particular I'm very keen on. Because obviously your BBC Radio 4, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen, has been back on again. That won some awards as well, didn't it?
Yeah, we did well for awards, and they started giving them to somebody else because they had to. But no, that was great, working with French and Saunders, especially since Dawn French is from Plymouth. And I was briefly at school with her brother, but never knew. So it's not what you know, it's who you know in this life.
Wonderful Eggpod Express.
So in this episode, we're talking about an issue of Disc and Music Echo from 1966. So why did you pick this one?
I picked it because it's the print date officially is May the 14th, which was my fifth birthday. And while I wasn't reading anything apart from Tiger Tim Weekly at this point, I just thought it was a good starting point. And also 1966 is, as we will no doubt discuss, a weird year in pop.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking before about, say, Sam Mendes made a film about the 60s and he put some music magazines in it. It'd primarily be the Stones and the Beatles, wouldn't it? But this is full of all sorts.
Yeah, it's like the difference between when you make a drama or art and the real slice of life thing is that it's not all kings and queens and emperors, which in this case would be the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and the Kinks. To fill a magazine like Disc and Music Echo, as I know from my own time at the NME in the 80s, to fill a magazine like this, even 20 pages, you really have to cram in everybody. And there's so many records. Like, in a world without an indie scene, you know, the NME was easy to fill up because they were releasing dodgy singles by the bucket load. But in the 1960s, major labels were signing everything in sight. And they were always on the lookout for a new Beatles or a new Tamla or a new anything. So it's a great time for singles as well. There's hardly any album information in these magazines. No one's sitting down going like, yeah, I sat down, listened to the new album. It's going to take a few listens. People are like, bam, single.
Yeah.
Wonderful Eggpod Express.
So as I say, we're looking at Disco Music Echo, published on Saturday, 14th of May, 1966.
Cool. My birthday was on a Saturday. We probably had egg and chips and went to walk on the hoe.
I can tell you exactly what was going on then. But a bit of history first. So Disc was a weekly British pop music magazine, first published in 1958 as a rival to Record Mirror. And as you say, it focused strongly on pop charts, unlike, say, the Melody Maker or the NME. But it compiled its own UK singles chart, and it had about 100 record shop samples, and even awarded silver discs for any 250,000 plus UK sales. That was eventually replaced in 1973 by the British Phonographic Industry Awards. And it's a good-looking magazine. It's notable for the colour, front and back covers, which was obviously very unusual at the time. So in 1964, it was renamed Disc Weekly. Then after absorbing Music Echo, which itself had earlier taken over Merseybeat, it rebranded as Disc and Music Echo. Writers included Jack Good and John Peel, cartoonist J. Edward Oliver, and in June 66, it was the first magazine to print in full colour the Beatles' Butcher cover. But I can tell you what was going on your birthday anyway, or around that time. Capitol Records were going to release the Beach Boys' 11th studio album, Pet Sounds. Bob Dylan's currently on his infamous tour of the UK, first half of his set being performed acoustically, but the second half of his set augmented by the Hawks and all the heckles by the rickety old folk puffins. On this day as well, Wembley Stadium, Everton beat Sheffield United 3-2 in the 66 FA Cup final. And around this time, the Politburo of the Chinese Communist Party released the May 16th notification, Chairman Mao's official justification for the Cultural Revolution, and Muhammad Ali knocks out Henry Cooper in six rounds to win the heavyweight boxing title. But, David, do you want to know what was on telly on the day you were born?
Yes, please.
I'm glad you said that, thank you. 11:15, Grandstand, covering the Cup Final, David Coleman and Bobby Moore. 5:20, Jukebox Jury, David Jacobs plays host to this week's panel, Helen Shapiro, Jimmy Witherspoon, Janice Whiteman and Frank Duvall.
Wow, the heavyweights.
There's also some music on ITV with the Rolling Stones on Thank You Lucky Stars, where they performed Lady Jane, their latest single, Paint It Black.
Tell you what, not where I live, they bloody didn't. Down in Westwood, we got anything. I didn't even know what rock music was until 1990.
Really? You might have got Doctor Who, though. That was on tonight.
Yeah, we definitely got... My dad says I saw the first episode of Doctor Who from my pram, which is a bit worrying since I was 1.5 at the time, but true story.
The Gunfighters' Johnny Ringo is this week's episode. Events in Tombstone take a turn for the worse when gunslinger Johnny Ringo is hired by the Clantons and shots are fired in the jailhouse.
Did it ever take a turn for the better in Tombstone, we ask ourselves? It's a nice day.
6:20, The Munsters. And 8:50, The Val Doonican Show with the Beverly Sisters and an early TV appearance by Dave Allen.
Oh, it's always a surprise when, you know, these great moments in pop history, like Revolver is about to come out. Meanwhile, Val Doonican's got the Beverly Sisters. And this was what culture really was.
Yeah.
My entire childhood is just this misery mix of light entertainment, westerns on telly and sport. So, yeah, thanks for reminding me what a hellhole life was.
Pleasure. So let's go to the magazine then. On the front cover, we've got Nancy Sinatra.
In colour.
In full colour, yeah. Her latest single's just jumped to number 20. And there's an exclusive Beatles new disc preview, promised on page 10. Nancy's Darling jumps to 20, and Wayne Fontana lashes out.
We'll never forget Wayne lashing out, and I believe his fellow former Mindbenders.
Yes, more of which later.
A classic split. It was a sad day for pop music when Wayne Fontana left the Mindbenders. And their two parallel careers that did not thrive.
For Disc and Music Echo, this is Tom Lodge bringing you Sound of the Stars.
So let's go to page 2. And first of all, there's an offer. Sound of the Stars, a sensation. And this is, you collect coupons to get a disc. It says... A fantastic reaction to Disco Music Echo's Sound of the Stars. Thousands of readers this week sent in their collection of 3 coupons from the first 3 issues of the paper. These qualified them for their copy of the star-studded free LP, Sound of the Stars, featuring the actual voices of the Beatles, Dusty Springfield, Spencer Davis, Walker Brothers, Pete Townsend, Sandy Shaw, Adam Faith, Cliff Richard, Cilla Black, The Shadows, Judith Durham, Kathy McGowan, The Hollies, Bachelors, and Radio Caroline disc jockey Tom Lodge. And we've heard this, haven't we?
Yeah, it's amazing. I've always been a sucker for a star-studded flexi-disc. Smash Hits did a very good one in the 80s. And it's nice to see the tradition brings here. It's an album, basically. It's about 15 minutes long. And what I love about it is you've got some really nice bits of Beatles, apparently some outtakes from one of their Christmas records included. But also you've got completely random conversations between, I don't know, Penny Valentine, their fantastic writer, Pete Townsend, and two of the Walker Brothers. And it creates this it's not an illusion, this impression that pop in the 60s, before rock and after light entertainment, was this huge club. and you go out to the speakeasy and the ad lib and you get hammered with the Kinks and, you know, have a laugh with Lulu and so on.
Yeah, it's a great listen, because it's described as an LP, but it was actually a 7-inch flexi disc, but it played at 33 and a third. And it was devised by Tony Barrow.
He's Beatles PR and sleeve note writer.
Yeah, yeah. But it sounds, as you say, everyone's so friendly, and it sounds to me like a 1966 podcast.
What I really like is just the immediacy. Nobody's thinking about legacies or making statements like Bono. People are just going like, yeah, I pranged my car last week. Oh, I bet that was annoying. It was a bit. It's not like show busy, but it is just people who meet each other on the circuit.
Yeah. It's in the days before publicists, so things like The Bachelor's chatting to Cilla Black about Cilla's new Mini.
Anyway, I'm buying a new car, so...
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
What's the car?
A Mini, but it's sort of, made up to look like a Rolls. They call it Mini Rolls, so I should have it by July.
But I'm afraid to drive, because I had a nasty accident a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, Declan, what happened to you?
I was going along the road, and that's last I remember.
I know,
it was all right. Only my head. See, there was a little part in my head.
Yes, I also noticed a few grey hairs, Dad.
It's the worry, Cilla.
Yeah.
See, you worry me.
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't get through nowadays. Can you mention the record?
Yeah. And Dusty Springfield and Spencer Davis discussed the songwriter Jackie Edwards.
I was just saying about Jackie Edwards. He sort of suddenly came to the fore as a songwriter. I got an old record of his. And then he suddenly appears writing your two big ones.
Yeah, that's a fact. Yeah. He's also written Wayne Fontana's Come On Home.
Yeah?
Yeah, Wayne's done a very good job on it as well.
You know the one before, somebody help me.
Keep On Running.
Yeah, did he do it? Keep on running.
Yeah,
oh, did he write it like that?
The demo disc we had, in fact,
keep on hiding.
Was just a piano and himself.
Or did he do
this, backbeat thing? You mean.
Did he do the backbeat?
Yes, just like that.
Isn't that funny?
And Penny Valentine again. Yeah, she's speaking with John and Gary from the Walker Brothers, along with Pete Townsend.
How do you feel about sort of people that pull you off stage and things, Gary?
Oh yeah, it's great. Actually, it's kind of expensive though.
Does money mean an awful lot to you, Gary?
For me? Mm. Oh yeah, I think it's great. Yeah.
Money invests itself. I mean, if you write songs, for example, you don't get the money for sort of 10 years.
No.
So you know, it's a kind of an investment. You know.
It's bizarre, the relationship. People are always rude about music journalists, but the relationships between music journalists and musicians have always been really important, because, you know, musicians want to have it both ways. They want to criticise people when they're slagged off, but when they've got something they want to get to the public, you know, they will use journalists. I was once pulled over by Elvis Costello in a pub to tell a writer from the NME that he was unhappy with the review. So like, fuck all to do with me, Four Eyes. I didn't say.
I was going to say, because we never really talk about your time at the NME.
No, there's reasons for that.
What was your relationship generally, other than Costello, with the celebs?
Well, it was bizarre, because you could always tell the ones who were going on there who were ambitious, because you never saw them, or they never spoke. I remember for years, I finally noticed that whenever you saw Damon Albarn in public, you'd sit with him, but his manager would do the talking while he stared at you. Whereas bands like Lush, you were always seeing in the same bars as the journalists, which I enjoyed that. But you remember thinking, this isn't the way to stardom. But yeah, they did kind of use us as mouthpieces, but they just didn't like it when we didn't. You know, there's always that thing of like, you can't give us a bad review, you're not qualified. And yet when I give you a good review, I'm suddenly immensely qualified.
Yeah, I think it's on YouTube, so it's definitely worth listening to.
I have to say that it actually... Dusty talking to whoever it was about Jackie Edwards drove me to find the original Jackie Edwards version of Keep On Running on YouTube. So it's a lot of fun.
Keep on running. Keep on running. You know I'm gonna find you, baby, one day before I say it.
Kids, all the music in this broadcast that we're doing now is pretty much on YouTube, and it's fantastic. Stuff you can't get on CD or Spotify. There's tons of lost singles out there. It's wonderful.
It really is. Yeah, I've been on some tip-tops. Tom Lodge from Caroline, his brief interviews with the Beatles, and he's asking if they've got ghostwriters for their songs, and John says...
We've got Gershwin and Trotsky. They write the first four.
And Lenin and Blavatsky writing the lyrics.
Yeah.
The two of the best selling lyric writers in the country.
We just do the PR for the boys, you know.
Yeah, we just do appearances and our mop tops, you know.
Yeah.
Wow, it was Madame Blavatsky, wasn't she? A mystic.
Yes, yeah. But they also declare their support for pirate radio stations.
Cool.
What's your attitude towards commercial radio on land?
Yes, I don't mind where it comes from, you know, as long as it's there.
Yes, I think I'd go along with that. I think you might as well have it in the middle
get
of...
Get the local angle, you know.
Get the local news.
The local angle.
You'd like to see local commercial stations?
I would like to see them. I'd just like to hear them.
Thank you very much. Ringo?
Yeah, I would. You know, more stations the merrier, I always say. You've heard me say it before.
Well, I think if the BBC can be legal on land, then so can everybody else. You know, that's how it should be. Or they either have nobody doing it or they have everybody doing it, don't they?
So I think by the end of the year, it came in, didn't it, that they were officially going to get rid of them.
Unwittingly ushering in the premise for The Boat That Rocked by Richard Curtis. Oh,
yeah. But yeah, it's a really nice listen. Copies are available to buy, and they can reach anything from £1.50 to a bit more. So well worth buying.
And it's on YouTube.
Yes.
Wonderful Egg Pod Express.
And then we have Scene, which are kind of like snippets of gossip and news, aren't they?
And I used to write the Enemy gossip column. And, oh, God, it was a horrific job. Teasers, it was called, then Public Enemy. Because none of us were giddy socialites. We weren't out. You know, we went to gigs and launches, and it was a desperate job. I used to make stories up.
Did you?
And I did. The weirdest moment was I once made up a story where Morrissey allegedly told a journalist he used to go to the Round Rotundum Library in Manchester, and he would knock the chairs against the tables to create an echo, which is a feature of that library. And I was slightly surprised years later to see Morrissey say that he used to go to the Rotunda Library in Manchester and knock the chairs.
No.
Yeah. And I never, now it occurs to me someone may have stolen the story, but it was so hard. So reading this column, when you see things like Wayne Fontana dying to do a double act with Spike Milligan, or Mick Jagger's latest possession is a week-old dark blue Aston Martin sports car, you know what? How hard-won those nuggets of factoid were. And just, Henry Mancini recorded House of the Rising Sun. That's not gossip. Isn't Andrew Oldham trying to pattern the Stones career on that of the Beatles? Meow. But it's fascinating, these little snippets that are not terribly accurate. And also, fetish, we'll be talking about it later, worth televising, Barry Fantoni's Impressions of a Drunkard. That's the number two item. Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan are number one. Barry Fantoni, an obscure but important 60s figure, is the number two item on this list.
Yeah, Above, which was released this week. Disc Hollywood writer Derek Taylor says the Beach Boys' new LP, Pet Sounds, is fantastic. Heavily inspired by the Beatles.
Hilarious.
I think one in here is worth highlighting. It's Rolling Stone Keith has bought a house in Sussex. It's gorgeous and has a moat around it, he says. Now three Stones live in Sussex. Bill and Charlie moved there last year. And this is Redlands in West Wittering, which obviously the following year was the scene of the infamous drugs bust.
It's amazing. Oh, my favourite, by the way, is Benny Green wrote the lyrics of Modesty Blaze, which may mean nothing to you, but Benny Green was like the Radio 2 and several magazines jazz critic. He was an immense, really good figure in the history of light entertainment and making documentaries. But to me, he's always famous for his review in Punch of the Dennis Potter series, Pennies from Heaven, which he slagged the arse off because the music played was anachronistically wrong. It was like Rolling on Prairie Moon didn't come out in 1937, which is like, nobody cares, Benny. Go with the flow. And the fact that he got to write the lyrics to, you know, a cool, ironic Italian spy movie pastiche, Modesty Blaze, is just old meets new.
Absolutely, yeah. Just wanted to say, going back to Redlands, I love the future story of the cursed place. In 1973, Redlands was almost destroyed by fire, So while some claim that Keith had fallen asleep with a lit cigarette, which he'd previously done during the recording of Exile on Main Street, when he awoke in his rented villa in the south of France to find his bed on fire, Keith actually claimed it was caused by a mouse munching through electrical wires. And then in 1982, 65 firefighters were called back to Redlands after another hungry mouse had once again left the property engulfed in flames.
Of course, I mean, Keith was quite lucky compared to Brian Jones, who famously drowned in his own swimming pool in A.A. Milne's house.
Yeah.
I sort of imagine a scene in one of those awful biopics that they do with Benedict Cumberbatch playing A.A. Milne. And he's sitting there talking to the real-life Christopher Robin while a corpse in a blonde wig floats face down unobserved in the swimming pool.
Even though you say you love me, what you want is too much of me. Stay with me. Let's try and talk it out. Baby, stay a little while, baby. Please, just a little while, baby. Stay a little while, baby. Then you'll find I'll see things your way.
Also on this page, now Proby's pal is chart chasing, and this is Barry Benson, hairdresser. And what I love about this, exactly what you're saying, because this guy was part of the Larry Page stable, so I had a bit of a search round, and his song at the moment, which is Stay a Little While, is really good. It's verging on Northern Soul, but it's not really. It's more poppy, and he's got this kind of falsetto voice, and it's fantastic. Go and hunt it out, everyone.
I will definitely do that. Another day, I've often been mistaken for Proby's brother, he admits. I've also been told I look like Jimmy Tarbuck, Dave Berry, Paul McCartney, and the Ryan brothers. And, you know, he's kind of right. He has a kind of shapeshifter face. He looks like everyone in the world.
He does, yeah. He could be in the new Sam Mendes movie, I think.
Oh, my. I mean, the worst Beatles in television history are definitely the ones in the Doctor Who episode.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a shame, since the actual Beatles, as we know, were technically in Doctor Who on a TV screen in the first season episode.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's not Paul McCartney's double, though. He's got too much nose going on. Barry Benson tunes in to hear his name and bursts into tears. 60 years long.
Sorry, Barry.
Stone you when you're trying to be so good. They'll stone you just like they said they would. They'll stone you when you're trying to go home. They'll stone you when you're there all alone. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
So he turns to page 3 and it's charts. First of all, the singles, and I think, David, there's a distinct lack of Beatles here. And while they're away, the new direction of music is pretty well taking place independently, especially at the lower end of the charts.
Yeah, it's one of those things that the Beatles are the elephant in the room of pop, and they fill it so much. And, you know, everybody at this point and later was influenced by the Beatles, and people covered the Beatles. And we kind of take it for granted that the Beatles are this great monolith of pop. So here we are, a chart without any Beatles. Mm. And I'm not even sure if there's a Beatles. I think there might be a Beatles cover in there. I haven't checked that thoroughly. But I think it is genuinely a Beatle-free zone, ironically with Sound of Silence. And it's interesting to see, as you say, the diversity of 60s pop at this moment, that you've got soul, you've got rock, you've got the Bachelors, who are amazingly popular at this point. You've got Pinkerton's Assorted Colours. You've got Rock and Roll. You've got Roy Orbison. You've got Jimmy's. It's extraordinary. And no beat. It almost answers that question that Richard Curtis, again, was so fond of asking. What would the world be like without any Beatles? Well, May the 14th, 1966, the Disc and Music Echo chart tells you.
On a block, all of the guys call a flamingo.
But I mean, yeah, we'll quickly go through. I mean, Manfred Mann, number one with Pretty Flamingo. This is
composed. I hate that song.
This Sorry. Might make you like it more. It was composed by Mark Barkham. He was famous, the music director for the Banana Splits.
Oh.
And he co-wrote the theme tune with Richie Adams.
Okay, now I like it.
Yeah. He also later went on to compose for the Archies. But you can kind of hear it when you think of Pretty Flamingo. Yeah, that could be a Banana Split song.
It's an unusual... Pretty Flamingo, la la la, la la la, yeah, it's got... It's pretty up... Manfred Mann at this point had done all these kind of jaunty, jerky R&B type songs. So it's their most pop record until... I don't know, Blinded by the Light.
Yeah, it wasn't long after this that Paul Jones would leave as well.
Privilege, 1967.
Oh, brilliant. Love that film.
Peter Watkins, yes. And you've got, the kind of the American folk rock coming in. You've got Daydream with Loving Spoonful.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream. Dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn.
Mamas and papas are on their way.
Monday, Monday, so good to me. Monday morning, it was all I hoped it would be. Oh, Monday morning, Monday morning, couldn't guarantee that Monday evening you would still be here with me.
The Birds going a bit rock with 8 Miles High.
8 Miles High, and when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known. Signs in the street that say where you're going are somewhere just being their own.
Yeah, but this is the thing, as you say, yeah, the Beatles are away, and in this one week, it's a new entry for Monday, Monday, Mamas and Papas at 33, new entry for Rainy Day Women, 12 and 35, by Bob Dylan, and 39, 8 Miles High by the Birds. So music is progressing, you know, because when I say the Beatles aren't, you know, their last single was Day Tripper, We Can Work It Out, back in the end of 65. It's just they're taking their time for the next single to come. And obviously working on Revolver. But the absence no one seems to be missing them.
The other interesting thing at this point is, I think it's been observed that the Beatles were kind of trying to cope with the new wave of bands, much as Kraftwerk found themselves scuppered by the 80s, when everyone goes, oh yeah, I can do that, and did Kraftwerk more commercially. The Beatles, you know, they'd made more rocky records like Day Tripper and I Feel Fine. And they're not struggling for a new direction by any means, but they are looking for one. Because the world, it's for the first time, the world's moved on without the Beatles. And there's been a bit of a breathing space. So the Beatles are trying different styles. They're doing guitar stuff. And when the new thing comes out, it's considered by some people to be a disappointment. Yes. We'll talk about that in a while. We just have a quick mention for the fantastic Walking My Cat Named Dog by Norma Tanaga.
Yes.
Who was close with Dusty Springfield. And it's just one of those records. Yeah, it's a one-hit wonder, but it's brilliant.
It is. It's a fantastic song, yeah.
And can we also have a quick note? I said no Beatles, but first instance of massive George Harrison plagiarism note with Sorrow by the Mersey's, which is the first time that George publicly, even before something, lifts someone else's lyrics and or tune without crediting them.
If you can get away with it, get away with
it. And he did several times. I mean, you can see why he thought he'd get away with My Sweet Lord. He'd already been farming James Taylor and the Merseys.
My daddy told me that
Top of the page, there's an advert, new LP from Small Faces, and this is their debut. So it's a 12-inch mono album on Decca, and it's a weird old collection. You've got the old singles, Sha-la-la-la-li, What You Gonna Do About It, as well as a few self-penned numbers, including the excellent Come On Children. As with so many albums at the time, you know, there's so many R&B covers, but they do Sam Cooke's Shake and Willie Dixon's You Need Loving, which obviously Robert Plant loved.
He loved it quite a lot, didn't he?
I love the story, Jimmy Page's version of it, that he says Jimmy played him the riff for Whole Lotta Love to put some lyrics on and was a little disappointed that Robert returned with a copy and paste strip of this version, although not disappointed to give it a songwriting credit of Page and Plant. But I think the whole album is basically Led Zeppelin 1.
Wow.
When you hear Steve Marriott's vocals, it could be Led Zeppelin 1.
So now my troubles are all over. Pleased to find that I was right and they were wrong. I half messed up my mind. You see those colors, hear those voices.
I find the whole bizarre rock family tree thing of them, they were treated very badly by labels, so it's quite hard to find a coherent Small Faces collection. Then they do this one brilliant Ogden's, you know, psychedelic music hall, really just slightly insane. Anne Nightingale used to play Lazy Sunday every Sunday afternoon. And I always loved the fact that it went from a Cockney knees up into a soul belter. I thought that was a genius move.
Oh, bless
you. Then, of course, you get the Faces and then Rod Stewart's in it. And then you get the whole Ronnie Lane, who's now a massively popular cult artist.
Yes.
Humble Pie. And then sort of the sad ending of the Small Faces reunion in the 1970s. It ends with the death of Steve. Just, they're one of those bands that are kind of huge in the mind and yet not huge in the world. And they made a great single, Sha-la-la-la, Tin Soldier, which is probably the first heavy metal record, in my opinion.
I'd go along with that, yeah. Because at this point, Jimmy Winston had left, but he does appear on the album, so it's half him, half Ian McLagan. The reason he left, there was ego clashes with Steve Merritt, because he didn't look the part as he was older and crucially not small. But it was Jimmy Winston's brother who owned the van and insisted that he be paid, and they didn't want to pay him.
Of course, being the Small Faces, if they got another small person, they could have just gone round in a mini, to be honest. They don't really need a van. They put all the gear in the front seat.
But Jimmy was the first member of the band to have suspicions about Don Arden, who famously held Robert Stigwood out of the window when he tried to sign the Small Faces. But Don Arden's way of paying the band a weekly wage, despite, you know, all their success, I think Howard and Blakely did the same sort of thing. He said you can also have accounts with clothes shops. So what they had to do was buy a ton of clothes every day and then sell them to their mates to get a bit more money in. But this also makes me think on a bigger question. Where are we now? May 66. You think rationing and the impact it had on the mod scene, because you think rationing ended in 1954. All these kids have grown up with nothing. And now they're earning more money than their parents, musicians, are, and they're buying colourful clothes. I'm sure the end of rationing had a big impact on the attitudes of the 60s.
I think so, because America had never gone through that kind of lacking thing that Britain had. And it's interesting that technology evolved, you know, first of all with black and white and then into color, just because that's the way we think of the world, especially at that time. And look at National Service as well. I think the Beatles are like one of the first generations to escape National Service, which of course Elvis didn't in America. And it really is a cutoff point. I also keep thinking of how terrible these clothes must have been. I may be completely wrong, but all the shoddy Carnaby Street clothes, you know, I mean, Don Arden was getting his money's worth, just giving out vouchers for crappy clothes. They weren't beautiful Italian suits at this point, I believe. Also, all famous people are short. They all look like Funko Pops. They've all got famous people have got massive heads and tiny bodies. They're like elves. That's how you can tell. If Lord of the Rings was made now, there'd be a cohort of famous people with their massive heads and tiny bodies coming to aid Frodo.
Spending too much time away. I can't stand another day. Maybe you think I've seen the world, but I'd rather see my girl. I'm going home.
So let's go to the albums charts. At number one, it's the Rolling Stones' Aftermath. Fantastic album recorded at RCA in California in 3 days in December 65, and 4 days in March during breaks between their international tours. And I think this is sonically so much different to their previous recordings. And there's a lot of experimentation, and particularly good news for Brian Jones to explore all this new instrumentation. Yeah, notably the first Stones album entirely credited to Jagger Richards.
Is it all originals?
Yeah, I definitely recommend this. Probably one of my favourite Stones, if not my favourite Stones album, I think.
I'm not talking about the kind of clothes she wears. Look at that stupid girl. I'm not talking about the way she combs her hair. Look at that stupid girl. The way she powders her nose. Her vanity shows and it shows. She's the worst thing in this world. Well, look at that stupid girl.
One thing, though, I do have a theory about this. Because one of the many criticisms, it's not things like Under My Thumb and Stupid Girl on there. It's lots of criticisms about the countless songs drenched in misogyny. But Mick Jagger was actually going through a rough patch with Chrissy Shrimpton, who he'd been seeing since 1963. And Keith had just split up with his girlfriend, Linda Keith. I'm guessing that undoubtedly had an impact on some of these bizarre lyrics. But also have another theory. So if we turn to page 6 of this magazine, there's an article, this is Stars in the News, and it reads, Autumn start to shooting in Britain. Stones film all fixed. Rolling Stones will get $1 million for their first full-length feature film, which has now been definitely fixed. Mick, Keith, Brian, Bill and Charlie will all have leading roles in Only Lovers Left Alive, a dramatic, imaginary story of the conquest of England by violent and rebellious youth. Shooting will start on a location in Britain in early autumn, and the film is to have a musical score with songs by Jagger Richards' songwriting team. So I'm thinking maybe the lyrics are character-based rather than them slagging off their girlfriends.
Yeah, I wonder.
But it's an interesting story because other bands, such as Jerry Pacemaker's done Ferry Across the Mersey, Dave Clark 5, Catch Us If You Can, and so on. Spencer Davis' Ghost Goes Gear, I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, yeah, it's the one that's got Graham Bond Organisation. I was reading about it the other day. It's got Charlie from Casualty. And if you're a fan of New Wave, it's got the first band of Dave Formula from Magazine in it. Wow. Dave Formula being one of those fantastic people who'd been around in the 60s but was not successful. So he was able to come back. And of course, Dave Formula is the greatest post-punk name of all time. Combination of Formula and Dave. I've been called Alan Experiment.
Background on the film. So a few months earlier, it was reported that the Stones were starting work on another movie called Back Behind and In Front. There's some confusion over who was going to direct what, but they started work on the soundtrack at RCA Studios. what ended up on Aftermath, but it never happened. So fast forward to this issue of Disc and Music Echo, and they announce Only Lovers Left Alive. So Alan Klein had purchased the film rights to the novel by Dave Wallace. Now, whether this is the same, as I say, as Back Behind and In Front isn't clear, but either way, this is the information available. The plot is as follows. All adults have died by suicide, and teenagers are left to their own devices. Gangs war with each other, while more sensible teams try to establish a new society. Andrew Lou Goldham thought the plot would suit the Stones, and I think it would have been a really good film.
I just like the idea of all of the more sensible teens trying to organise a government, which would just be a disaster. Imagine they're sort of like, let's meet in the library and after chess club, and the other teens are just smashing the place. I mean, it would have been interesting because there's something fascinating about rock musician acting that is almost always terrible. And, you know, Mick Jagger was probably the best actor in this. No, I think Keith Richards good in Pirates of the Caribbean, but he waited. But yeah, it would have just been surly people, which would have worked really, really well. It's the problem with the Beatles had, was they couldn't really act either, but they were forced to kind of be quite jolly.
Yeah.
And of course, the Beatles famously were offered up against it, the Orton vehicle and Lord of the Rings. Yes. I'm so glad they never did the Lord of the Rings. It would have been just vomit. It would have been like Magical Mystery Tour without the funny bits. But yeah, the history of the rock movie is... Honestly, you can basically keep Hard Day's Night and get rid of the rest. The end.
Yeah. Well, the Stones at this point, they had acting coaches.
Oh, God, poor acting coaches.
Keith said that they had to have elocution lessons due to the fact that they mumbled too much.
The thing is, though, I mean, we mocked, but Jagger obviously was really into it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, he tried and tried and tried. And again, it's like Bowie, if you find the right thing for him, Jagger's great in performance. Like Bowie's great in The Man Who Fell to Earth, but... I'm just trying to think of other films Mick Jagger could have ruined. No, I don't mean that. That's rude. But
wasn't still... he in Free Jack as well, I seem to remember.
Free Jack, that was the one. That was an 80s or 90s one. It was like his production company made.
Yeah.
And every so often he'll kindly do the theme to something like Slow Horses.
Well, baby, 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 you're out of time. I'll say, baby, 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 you're out of time. You are left out. Out of there with out of doubt. Cause baby, 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 you're out of time.
Back to Aftermath. I would say, yeah, go and get it. Lady Jane's on that.
Lady Jane.
Under my thumb.
Under my thumb. The girl who once had me down. Under my thumb. The girl who once pushed me around. It's down to me. The difference in the clothes she wears down to me. The change has come.
Flight 505, which is foreshadowing 70 Stones.
Well, I was happy here at home. I got everything I need. Happy being on my own. Just living the life I lead. Well, suddenly it dawned on me that this was not my life. So I just phoned the airline girl and said, get me.
And dries a swampy kind of beggar's banquet thing. Waiting with Brian's Dulcimer, brilliant album.
I am waiting over here.
waiting for someone to come out of somewhere. Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere.
Elsewhere in the charts.
The chart is like most of the media, even though, you know, we've had rock music for 10 years. Rock music is the enemy of the media, and the media hates rock music. So the chart has got Sound of Music in at number 2, Mary Poppins at number 9, Mantovani at number 10. Even Elvis is doing Frankie and Johnny. It's just anti-rock music, anti-pop music. And because there's no, at this point, apart from the pirates, no real outlet for hearing music. That's my theory.
Yeah.
And the contrast, you know, Aftermath, Sound of Music, Rubber Soul, is just bizarre. But that's the way it is. That's where the spending power is. And you compare it to the singles charts, which do have light entertainment drivelled in, but the singles charts are an explosion compared to the sedate bubbling of the top 10 LPs. Even the American charts are exciting.
But I think one I would recommend, number 6, the Spencer Davis second album, which is fantastic with obviously incredible musicianship. But they do a good version of Bobby Parker's Watch Your Step. But the astounding one is 17-year-old Steve Winwood. His piano and vocals on Georgia on My Mind is unbelievable.
Over on sweet, answer me. Although I smile tenderly, still and peaceful, drift I see. Oh, 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 it's back to you. Oh, oh, I said, Georgia. Comes a sweet and clear. Yes, moonlight through the pine.
It's so good.
By the way, absolutely, since the Walker Brothers are in the chart, you mentioned Steve Winwood. My personal theory, right? So there's a Steve Winwood album called Ark of a Diver.
Mm.
There's a track on Scott Walker's Climate of Hunter. The opening line is Stump of a Drowner. I've always been convinced that it was Scott Walker for no reason having a go at Steve Winwood. By the way, before we move on, I've just looked at the American charts here, and I am astonished beyond parody that in the American top 20 singles, Hermits have got a cover of Leaning on the Lamppost. Did you know about this?
Yes.
You didn't tell me. George, there's a George Formby. I mean, that is a... You know, I used to write parodies of Blur suggesting that they were doing I'm Henry VIII, I Am, but sure, Leaning on the Lamppost on the court. And it's right next to Shapes of Things by the Yardbirds, yeah. Which literally is a portent to the future. See, this is why we needed the Beatles. The Beatles needed to come in like bleach, get rid of all this pandering.
So from pages 4 to 6, we have Stars in the News. And this is exactly what it says on the tin.
The Stars in the, again, is sort of more gossip. I mean, the news is like one of the bachelors. So Bachelor John Stokes, driving down the M1 from Leicester, was so tired, he pulled onto the grass verge and, from a, I thought he was going to say, vomited all over the grass, but now spent the night sleeping in his car. I presume it's one of the bachelors. It could just be a... I once had a very weird phone call when I worked at the NME. It was a woman trying to get hold of one of the bachelors who she'd been engaged to.
Oh.
And... this was the 1980s, so we didn't really have any details. It was quite sad, but yeah. It was a bizarre moment, which also makes me think of The Bachelors.
Tonight, from Manchester, The Eamon Andrews Show. And tonight, Eamon's guests are Harry H. Corbett, Billy Whitelaw, Jackie Trent, Peter Maloney, Jerry Marsden, Sir John Barbarolli. And now, here's Eamon Andrews.
there's a gig guide, which is nice, and it's really brutal. It's just Maverick Man, Pavilion Ballroom, Buxton, St. Louis Union. That's the band that Dave Formula was in, and it's the Twisted Wheel in Manchester.
Oh, wow.
St. Louis Union. Fantastic.
Yeah, this countdown, it's incredible. This is every night of the week you can see bands for absolutely minimal money. But you've got everyone. Alan Prysett is doing the rounds, but it's Small Faces, Mersey's, Chris Farlow, Kinks, Yardbirds.
And it's also kind of random because they put in TV shows that people are on. Seen at 6:30, Granada, Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Eamon Andrews' show, Sandy Shaw. Presumably you then just go. I don't, it's not really if it's recordings or you can just go there. But yeah, what a world. Now, says Dave Clark 5, Georgie Fame, Johnny Kidd and the Cubas. They're a lost band.
Didn't want to have to do it. Didn't want to have to break your heart. Didn't want to have to do it. I kept hoping from the very start, but you kept on a trying, and I knew that you'd end up crying, and I knew I didn't want to have to do it at all.
On page 5, more news. Daydream Boys back in August. Loving Spoonful are to return to Britain in August for a 2-week visit. The group, who knocked London for 6 when they came here for a short visit last month, are waiting for a decision from the Musicians' Union on whether they will be able to tour here. Because of problems with the union on their last visit, the group were only allowed to do 2 TV appearances. It's unlikely that their American follow-up to Daydream, a Sebastian number called Didn't Want to Have to Do It, will be released as the group's follow-up single this country. So this was published on the 14th of May, 1966, and it was exactly at this time that Zal Ionovsky and Steve Boone were arrested for possessing an ounce of marijuana. It was because of that drugs conviction. Basically, it would end up into deportation because he was Canadian. So they became grasses, and they went to a party with an undercover policeman, identified the dealer, who was then arrested. And then, obviously, after that, this initiated a huge campaign with the underground press to boycott the band.
That's right, I remember.
Yeah. So by the end, beginning of 1967, the Loving Spoonful had lost a lot of respect by the counterculture groovy set, and that eventually resulted in tensions that got Zal sacked.
Golden days. If the counterculture is around the corner, sort of the beatnik generation is fading into something more aggressive.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the lightweight Loving Spoonful turned out to be grasses. Slags, scabs. And they were tarred and feathered on the Ed Sutherland show. I'm fascinated by this WHO bomb threat, which is not bad grammar. IRA warned don't wear union jackets in Dublin. And allegedly some Irish Republicans, this is before, you know, everything went horrific in the 70s for Bloody Sunday, but Irish Republicans have threatened to blow up the WHO with bombs planted under the stage if they appeared in Dublin's National Stadium wearing their famed Union Jack jackets. There was no bomb, possibly because these people slightly gave it away. It's like, do not tell everyone where the bomb is, but also it's clearly fictional. And apparently the WHO appeared wearing Irish flag jackets, which is like way to go. Fantastic moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just shows the nature of symbols to me.
According to, I don't know if you read the excellent Complete Chronicle of the WHO by Andy Neil and Matt Kent. As you say, I think the whole story has been a bit exaggerated, because the local support band the WHO were playing with called The Next in Line, and they regularly wore Union Jack T-shirts. So as you say, Pete still did change his number. But the gig wasn't particularly successful. The audience showed their allegiance with the local bands. They didn't want these, you know, fly-by-night London boys coming over. But there was a reception after the gig was held at the Intercontinental Hotel, where Pete was interviewed by journalist B.P. Fallon for Spotlight magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where he spoke freely about the use of feedback and drugs, which is something he does quite a lot at this time.
He likes speaking freely. B.P. Fallon, obviously a legend, one of those people who just turns up in rock history, particularly famous for being friends with Mark Bolan. But yeah, interesting to see him so early at this point. I think he might be immortal, to be honest. probably are a few people in more. Possible David Bowie reference. There's a gig in Ramsgate where 1,000 fans watched a bill, including Diane Ferraz and Nicky Scott, who have their own piece here, and the Riot Squad, which is a band that briefly hosted David Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
And were responsible for the first recording of a Velvet Underground song in this country.
I'm waiting for my man. 26 dollars in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. So sick and dirty, more dead than alive.
I mean, there are two eras in pop history which are just ridiculous. One is the sort of the early 80s indie and punk scene when, you know, the John Peel show would be filled with records that each of what which meant a lot to people. And the other is pretty much, I say, the mid-60s when people do go on about the chart, but the charts are this tumbling, world of experiment and insanity. Yeah. And just people using the three-minute format to get as much out of it as humanly possible.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, advertisers are trying to get kids to drink black gin called Bessenrude. Some of our partygoers drink black Bessenrude, the black gin. I bet they bloody don't. Oh, it's got blackcurrant. It's blackcurrant gin.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you can go to the Whiskey A Go Go. This is 1966, and they're advertising the fabulous original Drifters. Even then, the Drifters were having to bull themselves as... I think the Drifters, the band, was 60 different members over the years. I think they hold the record.
Yeah, often touring at the same time, aren't they?
Constantly. More coasters than IKEA.
When I'm feeling blue, all I had to do is take a look at you. Then I'm not so blue. When you're close to me,
turn to page 7, Wayne Lash's Mind Benders by Penny Valentine. I'm sorry to do this, he says, but they drove me up the wall. And this is the pretty acrimonious split between Wayne Fontana and the Mind Benders.
And he's probably a bit annoyed because as his new record, Come On Home, shot up the chart, giving him his first big hit for 6 months, don't think it did. Basically, Mind Benders had done Groovy Kind of Love at this point, establishing their toehold in the history of music with a genuinely great song that was, of course, later a hit for Buster from Genesis. But yeah, sort of, it's always not sad, but kind of weird to see people's careers sort of fading away in front of you. You know, as he speaks and says, I'm looking forward to blah, 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 you know that his career is vanishing and he's becoming a kind of chart ghost. Though he'll probably be doing, he probably was doing cabaret and stuff for decades and had more hits than me. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah, similar thing with Brian Paul and the Tremolos, I guess. Tremolos were far more successful once Brian Paul had left.
Silence, yeah, they sort of go in the harmony direction. And there's awful, possibly thanks to Brian Epstein, but there's an awful lot of groups with really good-looking and terrible singers with decent backing bands and sort of go in the group direction. But it's just the fallout from the end of Mersey Beat and the beat boom, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Diamonds of silvery rain in the fountains and 10 cent red roses from department store counters. Watching the moonlight reflect off the river beside where the trains cross the bridge and slow down. Trains with white letters on black iron sides and wild rushing water that all rolls away. And little miss someone does not want to stay. Everyone's moving with places to go. And Mr. Zero, he sadly stands still.
This one here, Keith's solo bit. Despite readers writing in calling Keith Relf the most fantastic male ever to hit the pop scene, it is because Keith and the Yardbirds feel they are faceless that they have all decided to improve their individual images by making solo discs. Keith said, all the members of other leading groups are known individually to the fans, but not us, so it seemed a good idea to try out some solo discs. Keith's solo debut is tomorrow, when his recording of Bob Lind's Mr. Zero is released. Bob Lind again. Jeff Beck releases an instrumental, is toying without trying out Alfie. Jim McCarty and Chris Dredger are working on a comedy number. Paul Semmelsmith may try record producing. Won't the Yardbirds as a group now get pushed back into the background? Definitely not, claims Keith. So yeah, there was an actual bid, or was it the fact that Jeff Beck wanted to leave?
Probably the latter. I mean, I love the Yardbirds. They are absolutely one of my all-time favourite groups. But they did suffer from this anonymity, and also because of the flipping guitarists, all that kind of training academy for great rock guitarists, i.e. basically encouraging people to ruin the 1970s. I don't like Led Zeppelin, and don't mind Jeff Beck, and I loathe Eric Clapton's work. The Yardbirds are just this fantastic group that they start off, you know, as a little blues band, and they're great. But Eric Clapton doesn't like pop, proving once again he's a moron. So he leaves, then they're getting Jeff Beck, who's fantastic. And then he leaves, and they're getting Jimmy Page, who is fine. But the Yardbirds just constant changes of direction. They're making, it's mentioned here, Over Under, Sideways Down, the album Roger the Engineer, fantastic pre-rock. And then they sign up with Mickey Most. It's like, I know what I'll do, I'll destroy your career. And they do Ha Ha, Said the Clown, and things like that. And yeah, they do become Led Zeppelin, but we've all got to, you know, work. So that was fine. And yeah, there is this old thing of just the solo single. Keith Relf does a couple of solos, and I love Keith Relf, but he's not one of the great singers, and he's not that charismatic, to be honest. Yeah, it's interesting for me to read this, to see this, why this record was released, and I wonder what Jeff Beck's instrumental issuing is.
It could be, yeah, Beck's Bolero.
Fair enough. Also, the dread spectre of light entertainment. Jim and Chris are working on a comedy number. No. They were always doing that. The Beatles were always doing that. We're working on a comedy number. We're working on a musical. You think, we don't need you to do that. We've got plenty of people who can write musicals and comedy numbers. George Martin going, oh, fantastic. I'll get the chains.
Below that, I found this really weird. There's an advert for Cilla's new album, Cilla Sings a Rainbow. And I was convinced, I've got this. And I think, well, I can't have it. And then, of course, it's all the old Beatles albums, all the old Parlophone albums, The Inner Sleeve, adverts for other albums. This was one of them, along with the Yardbirds one as well, Roger the Engineer, I seem to remember.
It is that, I love that, those Inner Sleeves. Just tell you, and of course, you never wanted these records. You never wanted Andy Williams' Greatest Hits. But you look at them, you'd be like, you get Simon Garfunkel's Greatest Hits, and you see inside there was a picture of Bridge Over Troubled Water. You're like, oh my God, they've made other records.
Yes, yeah.
And it taught you about the world. I was shocked when I got my import copy of Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl to discover that the Beatles' Hard Day's Night was called Quatre Garçons dans le vent in France. I'm like, how can they do this? And then I thought, well, I suppose A Hard Day's Night wouldn't make any less sense in French. Un jour de nuit difficile.
I don't believe you. You're a liar.
Turn to page 8, Cat Calls at Dylan opening as fans cry, Traitor! Bob Dylan arrived in London last week and went to sleep between black sheets at the Mayfair Hotel London. Bob Dylan, a thin, shocked-haired goblin figure with a smile like Brian Jones, a modern-day Rumpelstiltskin in dark glasses.
Yeah. I think one of the problems with Bob Dylan is that when people meet him, I imagine they try and be a bit Bob Dylan and get a bit more literary.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. But this is his UK tour, isn't it? There's a nice photo of him with Dana Gillespie.
Yeah. And again, no explanation of who she is. No. So she's obviously kind of a figure known to readers of Disc and Music Echo, of course, famous for her jazz things and also for her Bowie connections.
Yeah. She also did a cover, because it's when Billy Nichols did his album in 68, Andrew Lew Golden was trying to get everybody to cover the songs on it, because he wanted him to portray him as the English Brian Wilson. So he got Dana Gillespie to do her version of London Social Degree, which is a brilliant song if you haven't heard that.
If you pass it and you see and you've been hitting, you won't have to go to church to believe.
bit Dylan's tour in the UK, which is thankfully being documented by D.A. Pennebaker for the unreleased, officially Eat the Document special. But in a couple of weeks' time from this issue is when we get that incredible clip of John Lennon and Bob Dylan in the limousine.
Yeah.
It's the only known footage of them, the two of them together.
And I always love that moment because it's like Lennon cannot use any of his usual techniques of being rude, being smart, being aggressive, because Bob Dylan is just, and he's, you know, he is desperately admires Bob Dylan, everything he does, but is unable to get a foot in the door.
I read the papers of George Harrison, spent a lot of time in the States. You've learned a lot from George.
Tell me about the mamas and papas, Bob. I believe you're backing them very bigly.
I knew it would get to that. I knew it would get to that.
I believe you're backing them.
No, you're just interested in the big chick, right? You're interested in the big chick. She's got a hold of you, too. She's got a hold of you, too. She's got a hold of everybody I know. Everybody asks me the same thing, and I know what they mean.
One of them is
Do you know, do you know...
They're terrible, man. They're no
Ralph Donner is another great one.
Who?
He continues to be obsessed with Dylan, as we know, over the years. You know, some of the last things he records in the Dakota, Lennon, is like parodies of Bob Dylan songs, and you think, who are these for? And one of my favourite lines in the Beatles Illustrated Record, John Lennon's admiration for Bob Dylan took the form of silly peaked caps.
He was obsessed. Yeah, that's the only footage we have. But I think, yeah, the overall, everybody knows this story, don't they? Because it says earlier on in the gigs guide, you know, Bob Dylan's due to play at the Manchester Free Trade Hall. And it's this legendary, isn't it now, huge film based on this one-page article.
And yeah, it turns out that they've tracked down the person who shouted it. And it's, again, it's like, for some reason in Manchester, every time there's a gig that's famous, everybody in Manchester was there. Oh, yeah. Whether it's Bob Dylan or the Sex Pistols. Simply Red's first gig, yeah, I was there. But yeah, the D.A. Pennebaker film is great because he appears to have come to England solely for the purpose of being rude to everybody on an individual basis. But it's, I mean, not to be pretentious, but it's like this article is great, but it's kind of a teen, something you wouldn't get so much now. It's a teen magazine trying to cope with the Bob Dylan thing. I mean, you would get this now, but that something as vast as Bob Dylan and as baffling as Bob Dylan has come through the teen channels. So, you know, the Sunday papers can't deal with it. Academics can't deal with it. The teen papers are just pro-Dylan, and it just works really well.
Yeah.
From the end of the right, no wonder he lost his patience. No wonder he said that when he was asked intelligent questions, he would give interesting answers. And it is just the defending of Bob Dylan against the establishment is great.
Oh, well, he's sharing articles about the Troggs. Yes, we do try to be sexy. And Dave Clark out east, a wow. So it's like, yeah, this teen magazine plus this historic moment when Bob Dylan's heckled by the folk boys.
It's also interesting that the music press has progressed enough that the Troggs can talk about, a band could talk about being sexy. I'm sure this edition of Disc Music Echo was thrown away by several parents, you know, seeing their daughter reading it. Trying to be just completely out. Smash Hits would have run this in a slightly mocking tone.
Yes.
20 years later.
Yeah.
And it's very nice of the Troggs to try. I think this was run, I'm not saying anything rude about the Troggs, but the picture of the Troggs with the caption, sexy image gets them going. I think the subs were having a laugh there.
Switch your way if you choose. Go in search of the blues. But go now if you're going, because we're showing a whole scene going on. If you're tempted,
the next page, the Beatles are not stars, but Cilla is, says Fantoni.
Yeah, this magazine is obsessed with Barry Fantoni, a scenester, contributor to early Private Eye and a fixture at Private Eye until his death, in fact, pop TV presenter from the show A Whole Scene Going On. And just obviously everybody on the paper really likes Barry Fantoni. Sometimes when you read the music press, they will just have an obsession with somebody and write about them every week. And Barry Fantoni is the Marquis Smith of Disc and Music Echo. And he's clearly quite a cool guy. I mean, if you're filling a half a page by saying Barry Fandoni says that Cilla Black is a star and not the Beatles, then you've got space to fill, but it's just strange. Yeah. Oh, he says he's got a record. I'm doing my record on Whole Scene. Goodness me, I'm going to have to look up Barry Fantoni's record, should it exist.
Well, yeah, Whole Scene going is... I've been watching episodes. It's really good. It's hosted by actor Wendy Varnalls and Barry Fantoni. Like you say, he was an artist, cartoonist for Private Eye and The Observer. And it's very much like a 1960s version of The Young Ones nosing around. It's one of these youth kind of things. But it's good. It mixes up a bit like Nationwide, but with rock bands. But it was the first major British teenage lifestyle TV show, obviously focused on youth culture, including Carnaby Street fashion, London clubs, package holidays in Italy. It was a 30-minute weekly programme created by BBC producer Elizabeth Cowley after extensive regional research. But it covered fashion, art, sport, travel, cinema, social trends. And it was broadcast live every Wednesday at 6:30 in 1966.
The youth TV slot, the Janet Street Porter slot.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's got problem pages where pop stars are asked their advice and Lula is asked to give her advice about teenage relationships. It's got a filmed report on The Who playing in Hastings, which was nice. I'm still trying to find out what that venue was. Yeah, it's a really interesting show. It was axed quite quickly because basically when you've got Top of the Pops and Ready, Steady, Go, you've just got bands playing. And that's what people were more interested in.
Absolutely.
But it's always hard to bottle teenageness in a TV show. As it turned out at the time, what teenagers weren't interested in was watching people talk about teenagers.
Yeah. There's the famous footage, I think it appeared in the Kids Are All Right movie with Pete Townsend again, someone in the audience saying...
I've heard a lot about you and the rest of the group taking drugs, Pete. Does this mean you're usually blocked up when you're actually on stage?
No, but it means we're blocked up all the time, you know.
Going,
no, it just means that, you know, there are certain things levels of perception which are opened up by certain drugs that which people in the group don't mind resorting to. You know, I mean, you can ruin a night on the stage actually by sort of taking drugs. I mean, it doesn't necessarily make you play well. In fact, the best way to play on the stage is stone cold sober, but it's not the best way to do other things. You know,
you just can't stop talking about drugs.
He was very unfiltered, Pete Townsend. And then we got the hit news about the Byrds disc Banned on Drugs rap.
Yeah, 8 Miles High. It's been banned in Washington. Not surprisingly, really.
Yeah, surprised the BBC aren't in on this. I like the line, Jim McGuinn commented, we could have called the song 42,240 Feet High, but this didn't seem to be a very commercial song title. It certainly wouldn't have scanned.
Well, that's a new entry at 39, isn't it? And that's the Gene Clark, Roger McGuinn, David Crosby number. It's from the forthcoming Fifth Dimension album. But obviously, by the time this article appeared, I think Gene had actually quit the band. So things are moving so quickly at this time.
Lots of changes. They started off being folkies, and then they were basically the four George Harrisons for a short period. But in that weird moment when you can't tell who's influencing who, George Harrison's and the Byrds are sounding like the Beatles and George Harrison's sounding like the Byrds, and you get If I Needed Someone, that marvellous jangle all over it, their most Byrdsy Beatles song, and then they go country and then they forget all about it. And Roger McGuinn ends up in the 70s doing a solo album with Mick Ronson, which is just weird.
Next page, the reason the Beatles aren't about, their absence since the end of 65. Can the Beatles topple the Stones? Ray Coleman hears the new Beatles single. Controversy about which side of the new Beatles single should be the A-track is almost certain to break out when Paperback Writer and Rain go on sale on June the 6th. Both are, of course, excellent Beatles tracks, and after playing the sides to me this week, George Harrison said, we think it'll turn out to be another record like Day Tripper and We Can Work It Out. A lot of people said they preferred the B-side on that, but it takes time to get some of our stuff across. And anyway, if they think the B-side is better than the A, It means we've produced two good songs, doesn't it?
A very George attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, as a, like you, a massive Beatles fan, I am unaware of anybody claiming that Rain should have been the A-side of Paperback Writer. Excellent though it is.
It's difficult, isn't it? You think, yeah, mind you, 8 Miles High's been released. It would have been a very different chart if Rain had been in there as well, along with Rainy Day Women as well, in the same week.
There was some resistance, it would have been great, a certain resistance to Paperback Writer because it was seen as not a step forward and clever. You know, it's an early example of people having to go at Paul McCartney for writing songs that weren't about anything. Probably influenced by, you know, John having all his books out.
Yeah.
And lots of nice harmonies and, yeah, that slight birdsiness and Beach Boysiness to it. But now it's just a striking song.
Yeah, it's interesting to read at the time. So I always thought Rain people only got to after the event, but it seems, you know, they're really into it here as well. And he says, Rain is more plaintive and pretty and is a typically attractive slow Beatles melody. John takes lead vocal and the lyrics are based on the fact that whatever the weather, somebody will always complain. It will probably prove as popular with Beatles fans as Yes It Is. That was a B-side too, of course. And I love that song. I had no idea it was that popular at the time. You know, I didn't realise. I thought it was hidden away as an obscure B-side, but no.
How bizarre. Yeah, my uncle Ryan, it's weird nobody mentions the backwards bit.
No.
Which is what everyone talks about. And they go, oh, Ringo's best ever drumming. And, you know, now if we play this backwards, we can hear this. But people just, I don't know, maybe they thought it was the dog or something.
Yeah, there's no mention of it at all.
And the whole thing is a bit muted, really. The wait has been worthwhile. Paperback Writer and Rain are excellent Beatles songs. We'll give them a summer a hot start. That really is like, you've got 90 words to go, Ray. It's nice to see stuff about, slightly confused stuff about Revolver. Apparently George wrote I'm Only Sleeping. And the idea of a possible silver-coloured sleeve for Revolver or a photo negative. Definitely the idea of black and white, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Harrison has written two songs for the Beatles' new LP, Out in the Summer. One's completely finished, but with the other one, I'm not very happy with the lyrics. He uses the sitar again, and photographer Bob Freeman is working on the possibility of a revolutionary sleeve jacket for the album. He's talking about having it done in a silvery cover or put out just like a photo. This was the one that they used on the box set with all the
psychedelic.
Yeah, it's a brilliant thing. It sort of predates Ogden's Not
Gone.
Oh,
is that the one with all the boggly eyes?
Yeah, yeah, with lots of little heads.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a brilliant cover. I don't know why they used it, but then after you've seen Klaus Voormann's covers, you got to take that, haven't you? And that's the end of part one. However, you can listen to the whole interview at patreon.com/eggpod. Join us next week for part two to find out much, much more. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. And again, this issue of Disco Music Echo is online at iintheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular episode. But for now,